the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Cadet. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on all of the news that made headlines around our region this last week. And today, our panel includes Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Joe Parrish, reporter with KTVB Television, Christina Lords, the editor-in-chief of the Idaho Capital Sun, and Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun. Hi, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, happy Friday, everyone. I want to begin our conversation today with the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe versus Wade and how that is impacting Idaho. So, Melissa, can we start with you? And let's begin with some of the court cases here in Idaho in regards to what's happening in our state right now. In fact, I believe there is one that is that would try to stop the Idaho's trigger law from going into effect.
There are two current cases in front of the Idaho Supreme Court right now, both filed by Planned Parenthood of the Greater Northwest. One of them was filed a few months ago, and that is addressing the law that was just passed this last session that would basically allow family members of the fetus to sue medical practitioners and recover civil award if they determine that an illegal abortion occurred. There's currently a stay on that law, and oral arguments were originally scheduled for August 3rd. Just this last week on Monday, Planned Parenthood filed a lawsuit on Idaho's trigger law that would ban all abortions with narrow exceptions for reported rape, reported incest, or well-documented life of the mother issues. You know, so basically, it wouldn't be enough to say the mother could get sick or, this would adversely affect the mother's mental health. A physician would have to document very thoroughly that without an abortion, a mother would die. And so they filed that lawsuit. And late on Thursday, the Idaho Supreme Court issued an order regarding both of those cases. They're putting a hold on the August 3rd oral arguments for that first lawsuit that I told you about. And instead that day, they are going to hear arguments from both the state and Planned Parenthood on the two cases about whether or not those two hearings should be combined and the state should, or the court should consider both of those lawsuits at the same time, whether there should be a stay put in place on the trigger law that is still pending, and whether the stay that's currently in place on the other law should remain in place, and whether those cases should be moved to district court instead of the Idaho Supreme Court. Those will be on August 3rd. We're still kind of waiting to see how the day is going to shake out, whether all of that will be heard together or if it's going to be one after the other. But again, these are not oral arguments. These are, it's more consideration on how these cases will proceed moving forward. As of right now, there is no stay on Idaho's trigger law. We'll see if that remains true.
Okay. And then, Joe, I want to bring you into the conversation because KTVB, you have spoken with prosecuting attorneys around the state in regards to this latest decision to overturn Roe. What are these prosecuting attorneys saying about how these court cases could happen if someone were to, you know, to bring a case?
Well, to be frank, right now, there's a lot of unknowns and there's a lot of gray area. This week, I spoke with Grant Loebs, who's the president of the Idaho Prosecuting Attorneys Association. And talking with Grant, he's got a well-documented legal career. And he says, you know, this is a situation, frankly, that we just haven't faced, having a giant Supreme Court precedent, Roe v. Wade, overturned. And then you have about, 60 days or whatever to figure out how that's going to play out. The bottom line I get from prosecutors across the state and really from the Idaho legal community is there needs to be some significant crossover conversations between law enforcement, the prosecutor's offices, as well as the medical community. They need to come to at least an understanding, a working understanding, that is, on how you kind of dive through the language of what does it mean to save the life of the mother? What is a medically necessary situation? How do you even investigate these things? Do law enforcement like local police departments. So they need new resources to, I guess, investigate situations where there's a claim of an illegal abortion. It's a brand new world, and it's uncharted territory is a phrase I keep hearing from people in the legal community. The bottom line, though, is we're not going to know until it plays out. And as the first case plays out, if and when that happens, it's going to be a huge learning lesson. And a lot of people across the state will be watching. You know, in terms of, is this a more or less complicated law? The new Idaho abortion laws that, as Melissa talked about, are pending right now, in, you know, pending review. Grant Loebs tells me that in terms of doing the job remains the same as you read the letter of the law that the legislature has passed, and you do your absolute best to try to enforce the law in the spirit of it and how the legislature wrote it out. So I know it's frustrating right now for a lot of communities across Idaho because there are so many unanswered questions and there's so many gray areas, but that's just the reality we live in right now.
And I'm going to jump in here, Gemma, if it's okay. Yeah. You know, I also spoke to Grant Loebs, who, you know, he's the head of the Idaho Prosecuting Attorneys Association. And he told me that they will almost certainly be talking about this at their upcoming conference in August. Another thing that he brought up was, you know, whatever laws the legislature passes, it's not uncommon for them to revisit them in subsequent sessions if they see that there's language in there that doesn't work. Usually the stakes aren't this high, though. You know, and the stakes here are very high because, as Joe said, what does it mean to say the mother's life was in danger? How in danger does it have to be? How close to death? You know, ectopic pregnancy is a great example. You know, if you discover an ectopic pregnancy that isn't about to burst, you know, and injure the mother, it's imminent. But how much time do you need to wait to say, you know what, now this is an emergency situation? Is it enough that the ectopic pregnancy exists, or does it need to be a life-threatening emergent situation? The other thing is that we have 44 prosecutors in this state, and they're going to all use their discretion in different ways, and not just, you know, as individuals, but on a case-by-case basis, because all of these cases are going to be different depending on the facts. And there's a very real possibility that a lot of these cases aren't going to end up in court in the first place, because the prosecutor is going to say, you know what, I'm satisfied that the doctors have, the medical professionals have shown that there was an emergent situation here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, Melissa, that's such a great point when you look at ectopic pregnancy, right? Because, when an ectopic pregnancy happens, it, you know, there normally is a heartbeat. So therefore, under, you know, the law, all right, it's a, you know, you are going to be committing a crime under our trigger laws if you abort. Yet if you do not and you wait for there not to be a heartbeat, well, guess what? That's burst. And then how imminent is the death of the mother? And it is those shades of gray that we're dealing with, but also lawmakers who potentially don't understand how medicine works.
Well, and that's where that prosecutorial discretion comes in. They have medical experts that they can talk to. The thing that Grant Loebs really emphasized was, you know, if a case is well documented and physicians can show that we believe that this was a life-threatening situation, most reasonable prosecutors are going to say, okay, you know, there's a provision in this law that says if the life of the mother exempts this, it is a built-in defense against this prosecution. The thing that he really emphasized is while this plays out, doctors and medical workers need to document everything really, really well to show that this is how they came to the decision. And this is why they chose to go the route they did.
And I want to hop in too. Sorry, really quickly, I just want to hop in. There's two points that Melissa reminded me of. And, you know, it's a conversation I had with still talking about Grant Loebs. Is, you know, I asked him, you know, do you foresee a situation where you or your colleagues get a call in the middle of the night and it's a doctor saying, should I do this surgery? I don't know. And, you know, that's type of a nightmare situation. But, you know, Prosecutor Loebs telling me that, you know, he doesn't have a red phone that can light up every time someone has a question. So there is going to be this case, as Melissa just highlighted, you need to have extreme documentation and over documentation in case this does get into a court of law. And when we talk about a court of law, something that I thought was so interesting in this perspective with Prosecutor Loebs, prosecutors in Idaho are elected positions. So it's not out of the question that over the next few years, you could have a situation where you have people running for prosecutor on this simple item, or I shouldn't say simple, on, I would just say on the single item of abortion and how they would prosecute abortion. And I asked the prosecutor, I said, well, you know, what are your thoughts on a prosecutor that said, I'm not going to, you know, go after abortion cases, or I'm going to go after all abortion cases. And he says, in either situation, if you have a prosecutor that is, you know, showing their card, so to speak, before, you know, they even get into a courtroom, he thinks that's, you know, professionally a major problem, and it's not right. And that prosecutors need to be following the letter of the law and be following the facts of the case. But as we've seen in politics, it becomes very partisan very quickly. And it makes you wonder, are we going to start to see really nasty county prosecutor races that are really just about the issue of abortion?
Mm-hmm. And Joe, let's talk about HIPAA protections. This is something that I've been wondering about, that I think a lot of people have been wondering about. When our abortion laws in Idaho change later this summer, people's medical information is going to be on the line. You talked with a medical expert, Joe. What did they say? Because HIPAA is supposed to protect your privacy to your medical records.
Yeah. And I checked in with Kim Stanger, who's the head of the health law group at Holland and Hart here in the Boise area. And he and I were talking that, you know, HIPAA, and we talked about HIPAA through COVID for a variety of issues. HIPAA does provide some, you know, some face level or some base level protections in possible investigations into an illegal abortion. If, for example, you were to get a doctor on the stand in a courtroom and you're asking him questions about what he did in a procedure, if there's no exception to HIPAA made, the doctor cannot comment on that. So the situation you're going to get into is that you're going to need prosecutors or law enforcement to get subpoenas or warrants to, you know, access this medical information. Now, that private medical information is not just available. So there will be a situation where HIPAA does have some protections up until a certain point, because if you get a subpoena or if you go get a warrant in a court of law, is compelling law enforcement and compelling a medical community to produce information, you know, as evidence in a court of law, you're not going to be able to get around that. So does HIPAA provide some protections? Absolutely. But those protections, they can be got around pretty easily. And there are HIPAA exceptions that in terms of law enforcement, that they can navigate pretty quickly. It's important to remember HIPAA was never set up to, you know, be any type of a block or a legal maneuver in terms of testifying. HIPAA is really just meant to protect our personal information from medical providers. And so medical providers, you know, aren't just giving out our info. So it was a really interesting legal question that we heard a lot from the community about. But long story short, it sounds like there are some HIPAA protections, but when it comes to the bottom line for a court of law, a subpoena would likely undo all of that.
Right.
People think that HIPAA protects a lot more than it does. There are a lot of misconceptions about HIPAA. And you know, the bottom line is, if there is a subpoena, if there is an active investigation, prosecutors can get at that information.
Yeah, they can. Before we take a break, Joe, I quickly want you to talk to us about the fact that Idaho is bordered by states that will continue to protect individuals' rights to an abortion. Washington, Oregon, California, just to name the ones along the coast. Joe, any of these states, Oregon, Washington in particular, are they doing anything to ensure that Idahoans can still get access to this health care?
Yeah, and the state of Oregon actually has really been mobilizing, and they've really thrown a lot of money at this. This past March, actually, the Oregon legislature approved the Oregon Reproductive Health Equity Fund. And basically, the state legislature there put $15 million into a fund. And it's set up to do several things, but one of the things it's set up to do is to help cover abortion costs, as well as travel and lodging for those that may need it. Now, does that include Idahoans? Yes. I was talking to Oregon Representative Andrea Valderrama, and she told me that there are Idahoans that would be able to use these funds to travel from Idaho to go get abortion care or medical care in the state of Oregon. Another thing, though, that we have to think about, and that the representative in Oregon had pointed my way, is there are people living in Eastern Oregon, and their closest medical center was in the Boise or Meridian area. Now, with the laws changing in Idaho, there are people in Eastern Oregon that are going to be in a situation where they're going to have to travel west hundreds of miles to get the care they need. So that fund is also set up to help them. But this $15 million fund, a million of that has already gone to some organizations to help people like in the state of Idaho who could be looking for reproductive health care network connections. So it is interesting to see the amount of money that Oregon is putting into a fund. It will be interesting, though, to see how this actually plays out. But it is interesting that our neighbors to the west are mobilizing and using their tax dollars to cover Idahoans.
Yeah. An investigation by BoiseDev.com revealed some major safety issues with the construction project along Highway 55. Idaho Matters, we spoke with Margaret Carmel, who broke this story. I know, Melissa, you also talked with Margaret. And Audrey, I know you've been looking in this too. Melissa, can we start with you for folks who are not familiar with what we're talking about? Get us up to speed on what this investigation revealed.
Long story short, the public knew that there had been three rock slides at a construction site on Highway 55 around Smiths Ferry. So what we didn't know until the Boise Dev investigation from Margaret and her colleague, Autumn Robertson, was that ITD had indications that that area specifically was unstable, that it had been cut at too steep an angle, in layman's terms. It's a lot more complex. It's a phenomenal investigation at BoiseDev.com. The other thing that their investigation unveiled was that the second rock slide in November 2021 came very close to hitting a pilot car and some passenger cars that were going through. That's something that we didn't know before. There were a lot of questions about what ITD knew and when they knew it and what they did to prevent those rock slides and accidents from happening, because that, of course, is a major artery between Valley County and the Treasure Valley. You know, if you live in McCall, you can go on Highway 95, but if you live in Donley or Cascade or some of those other areas, you really depend on Highway 55 to get to the Treasure Valley. So the Boise Dev team had asked ITD a number of questions about, like I said, what they knew and when they knew it. And ultimately, they didn't get very many answers. They didn't get very many specific answers. And they revealed this in their reporting. This week, after that investigation, Governor Brad Little released a letter publicly, basically demanding those answers. And asking the transportation department what sort of media inquiries they had received and how they had responded to them. That's a conversation that's ongoing. ITD defended their actions. And Boise Dev last night reported that in their letter, the transportation department had misrepresented Boise Dev's reporting and the process. Don Day, the editor of BoiseDev.com, has been pretty transparent about their reporting process and how they got to the conclusions they did and why they made the editorial decisions they did. Again, you should check it out if you haven't already. It's phenomenal investigative reporting.
Mm-hmm. And Audrey, you've been paying attention to this as well.
Yeah. So, and my perspective, I think, is a little bit different. So I have written about ITD for the Idaho Statesman and again for the Idaho Capital Sun in regard to the quality of the materials going on Idaho roads. And it was interesting to see how, that the governor immediately asked the department to produce a report and then to see what the report said and to read Don Day's kind of column about how it misportrayed their reporting. When I had been working on this project in 2019 and 2020, I asked to talk with technical people who could answer questions that I had. I was not allowed to talk with them, and the people I was allowed to talk to could not answer my questions. And at one point, I asked them so many questions, and they did answer some of them. But at one point, I showed up at the headquarters expecting to be able to talk with these technical experts. And instead it was the same, folks that I had talked with before, and they wouldn't answer my questions anymore and gave me a written statement that was written in like third person. It wasn't to me, it was about my reporting, and it was just a really strange experience. I've continued to do ongoing reporting, and I will continue to do ongoing reporting. We have a project going on the materials quality issue still, but it was interesting to see how Boise Dev's reporting was portrayed in that report, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I do think that if any listeners, if you have read this investigation by Margaret Carmelinot and Robertson, and you have not read Don Day's response, it's important that you do so. And to understand all of the facts. And Melissa, I mean, this is, I don't want to say unprecedented, but I can't necessarily remember a time where there has been an investigative piece that's happened by a media outlet where the governor so quickly responds saying like, I didn't know any of this, basically, and you need to tell me.
I think one of the factors there is you as a boss, whether it is a private enterprise or as the, you know, executive officer at the head of multiple state agencies, you don't want to be surprised. This was a 6-month investigation that involved multiple public records requests. And it sounds like, based on that letter, the governor was taken by surprise. You factor mm-hmm. that in with, this is a governor who prides himself on fiscal responsibility. This is a governor who knows a lot about transportation policy and infrastructure. He was the head of the transportation study group under Governor Otter when he was lieutenant governor. I am not surprised that the governor was so upset considering all of those facts, because, you know, if you're a boss, you don't want to be taken by surprise like that.
Yeah. And to make it very clear, we have extended an invitation to the Idaho Transportation Department to come on our show and to talk about this story. We will let you know if they respond to that request. Moving on, Christina, I want to bring you into the conversation. Can you talk to us about how the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee is being accused of violating Idaho's Sunshine Law?
Yeah, so we published a story this week that outlines how the Idaho Attorney General's office is working alongside the Idaho Secretary of State's office to determine if a fairly new publication in North Idaho called The People's Pen is in violation of campaign finance and sunshine laws. Essentially, a complaint was filed by a woman named Sandy Patino, who is well-known in Idaho Republican politics circles. She worked for Senator Larry Craig's staff for 18 years. And she has concerns that the publication is actually being produced and paid for by the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee. And you, on first blush, you would assume that this would be kind of easy to figure out, but it hasn't been, because the publication itself doesn't include what you would normally see in a print product like a newspaper with contact information for its editor or its publisher or its staff. The only thing that's visible in the publication is a P.O. box that's registered in Coeur d'Alene. The Kootenai County Republican Central Committee has said, yes, we have advertised in this publication and reported those expenses to the Secretary of State's office, which is required by law for political advertising. But we're not running this actual newspaper. And so what's concerning is that the paper includes interviews and stories, really long stories about candidates that ran for the May 17th primary election that were endorsed by the Kootenai County Republican Central Committee. And there are negative ads against the non-endorsed candidates in those races. And so it looks in the complainant's eye, essentially, that this is a publication from the Central Committee endorsing and giving out information, favorable information on candidates that they endorse, and negative ads and negative press to the candidates that they don't.
Okay. Audrey, some news about Ammon Bundy and a lawsuit against him and another individual, Diego Rodriguez. This is in regards to an incident that happened at St. Luke's, their downtown Boise location in March. Can you get us up to speed on this?
Yeah, so St. Luke's and one executive at CEO and then a couple of healthcare providers whose jobs had been affected by this protest over the child protection case. They sued Ammon Bundy and Diego Rodriguez and their respective organizations, Freedom Man PAC and People's Rights Network. They sued May. and
2 months ago, I guess now.
Yeah. And according to the most recent court filings, Ammon Bundy has not responded to the lawsuit and Diego Rodriguez cannot be found. He's not at any of the addresses that that the process server could find for him. And so St. Luke's is saying, look, the things you need to respond to under a court order are you need to tell us about your organizations, who runs your websites, who has a financial interest in this, and who is responsible for publishing these allegedly defamatory comments. And so they have not gotten a response to that. So they're asking the judge to take action, basically to sanction Bundy. And that could take different forms. It could have him brought in for a deposition where he has to answer the questions instead of just providing the documents, or he could be held in contempt, or the case could just be ruled on based on what they have. So there's a hearing scheduled for July 12th on that, and we will see what ends up happening. The Idaho Statesman did report that they'd reached Rodriguez, and he said that he was in another country now, and that he'd be happy to meet with them on Zoom. So, but he hasn't responded in a legal way to the allegations against him either.
So, Audrey, talk a little bit more then about. I know you said there's a hearing on this coming up in about a week and a half, but. I mean, isn't Bundy required by law to respond to this?
That's a really good question. And that's where potentially the contempt could come into play. Okay. There are certain, and I'm not a lawyer, so
this is just
what I know from covering stuff in courts for a while. So you can have something called a default judgment where you've been sued and you don't respond, and so the default judgment is generally against you because you're not defending yourself, essentially. And so I guess that's an option here, but the contempt option certainly exists. One of the things that the St. Luke's attorneys pointed out is that it is not exactly unusual for Bundy to not strictly obey court orders, as in the case of his sentence for, his sentence over, there were a few different things that happened with Ammon Bundy.
Trespassing, things like that.
Right. But he was, yes. So he was sentenced to community service and reported gubernatorial campaign activities as community service. And the judge said, it was very clear that you were not to do this and you've done it. And so, so he had to go to jail, as a result of that. So the attorneys pointed out that, he has previously not followed court orders. And so they are seeking payment for one thing. They want, their attorney fees covered and their court costs and stuff like that, but also the judgment that they're seeking. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. If you're not cooperating with the court, what exactly does happen? Like, at what point does the legal process run out? And I think this is an interesting case to watch when it comes to that kind of thing.
Right. And I think that we will be, you know, all of us keeping an eye on that. Christina, Idaho Senator Jim Risch flew to Ukraine recently, met with President Zelensky. Why? And tell us what happened within this meeting.
Yeah, so over the last weekend, Senator Risch was in Ukraine to meet with the Ukrainian President Zelensky, and actually toured three cities in the country that have been affected by Russia's war in Ukraine. He's a ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and so he's been heavily involved in foreign relations work over the course of his career. One of the things that that he said that kind of stood out to me is that he said he's been to war-torn countries before, but he's never really seen people rebuilding as that war continues. And that really stood out to him about how resilient these people are, that they're, you know, still courageously fighting against the Russians. And he said, we could not let them down. And he's been an advocate for, you know, U.S. Assistance to Ukraine in the ways of weapons and airplanes and, you know, economic funding as well to make sure that Ukraine has the tools it needs to be able to continue this war. And something else that stuck, you know, sticks out to me is that Risch has really, when he talks about Vladimir Putin, you can just see and feel and hear the disdain that Senator Risch has for him. And he really views, you know, this attack on Ukraine as, you know, the Russia trying to take over more land and things like that since the Soviet Union fell. And he really believes that this is the beginning of more of that type of action. And he worries about how China could look at this and see it as an example and be more authoritarian in how it deals with foreign relations as well. So I think it was important for him to go on a personal level. You can tell that he's very passionate about this particular topic, and that he also really believes that without this kind of funding and aid and assistance and weapons and machinery for Ukraine, that it prevents U.S. troops from having to go there and fight. That, you know, he has said multiple times that the more we can support the Ukrainian people this way, the less that we'll actually have to put our own soldiers and troops on the ground in harm's way.
Mm-hmm. And how much do you think this visit will make an impact, Christina?
That's a good question. I do think that it's important that the U.S. Is showing up in these moments, and that I also think that, you know, as the war continues on, I think the American people are going to start to ask questions about how much money we're sending there, how much longer we're going to be involved in these sort of things. And I think it shows, A, the Ukrainian people that the United States is here and supporting them still, even after month, as this conflict continues to drag on. And it shows the American people that we have a role to play in some of these larger foreign conflicts that affect us all. You know, I think that we really do have to find solutions to some of these problems. And the American people are feeling the pinch of high gas prices and things like that, mm-hmm. as the world relies less on Russian oil and things like that. So I think especially for him, where he has felt so strongly about Putin's rise to power and how much more aggressive he's been and could get in the future, to show the American support to the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian president.
And I think you mentioned this, but just in case, if maybe you're just tuning in and listening to this, it's important to note that Senator Risch is the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, hence why he would make a visit like this.
Right. And there have been other members of Congress that have gone and visited as well. And so I think it's important to that body to make sure that we have senators and representatives that are still engaged.
Right. Audrey, more than 18 months after the first COVID vaccines were available and more than a year after the clinical trial started for children under the age of 5, COVID vaccines are finally available for these children who are 6 months to 5 years old. You recently did a really interesting story, I think, on parents and advocates questioning why it took the Food and Drug Administration so long to make this available. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, this was a story that was mostly done by a reporter at one of our sister outlets in New Mexico, Source New Mexico, and it the story basically looks at the fact that the Moderna clinical trials for the COVID-19 vaccine in young children and infants began in spring 2021. They had the data as of this spring, and then it took a few months for the FDA to actually review it for an emergency use authorization. And the issue that advocates and parents are bringing up is, this was done at the same time as Pfizer's. What's the deal here? Why did this get held off? And we're in the middle of another surge. We could have our children protected, but they're not. At this point, I don't think, aside from the children who were in the clinical trials, that any child has been fully vaccinated in that age group. So, the story talked with, sought comment from the FDA, did not receive any, but talked with some folks who have very closely watched the development of this vaccine, and kind of an unanswered question, why that data, why the FDA just kind of sat on that data for several months before authorizing the vaccines. But yes, they're now available. And on that story, we include a link to where you can very quickly find your local vaccination site for this age group. You can even choose which vaccine you prefer and hopefully quickly make an appointment.
Okay. And that's important for parents who need that information. And the fact that they can finally get this done for their children. Christina, why is the state of Idaho looking to sell Cougar Island? And for folks who aren't familiar, this is an island right in the middle of Payette Lake.
Right. This is an interesting one for me, because I think it all ties back to what is the mission of the land board, right? And the land board is the one that voted unanimously on June 21st to sell off Cougar Island. Their mission, their edict, is to get the most money that they can out of these endowment lands so that we can adequately fund public schools and things like that. But the crux is that people see Cougar Island as this beautiful part of Payette Lake. Many people, especially in the Treasure Valley, go up to McCall and spend time there, have a real reverence for our public lands and don't want to see it sold off. And it's really important that people understand that even the county commissioners, Valley County commissioners, are against this idea. The folks that make up the land board, which are people like the governor, the attorney general, superintendent of public instruction, statewide office holders, basically, that they're what they have to do is make the most money off of this land. But and Cougar Island has generated only about $32,000 in the last year, but it's been appraised at $4.8 million. And so if the state can sell off the island, they'll be getting essentially more bang for their buck, more in line with the mission of the land board. But of course, people want access to public lands and don't want to see houses or other folks cut off the access to that island. So we heard on, I think it was Thursday, that the auction is tentatively set for September 8th. So we're really in a time crunch here. And one of the reasons that the state wants to sell it now is because of, more and more the interest, basically more and more people coming in, the attractiveness of being able to sell this property right now before interest rates and things like that go up, where it would make less money in the sale. So it'll be a very interesting thing to watch. The Valley County commissioners are trying to put together a plan where they could actually buy the island from the state and keep it public. But we'll see if they're able to do that in this kind of truncated timeline that the state is looking at.
Well, and I mean, and then needing to find money, correct? I mean, you're talking about more than $4 million that a county would have to find that type of money.
Right. And that was the Valley County Commissioner's point of, you know, this is a really small time frame to try to find that amount of money, but they're raising funds as quickly as they can and trying to work out other solutions to what they feel like is a major problem for their county and for McCall, basically.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, can you talk to us about Idaho's PILT program first, what it is, because I bet a lot of folks are not familiar with it. But then how Idaho counties with the most federal land don't necessarily get more money.
PILT is a program. It stands for Payment in Lieu of Taxes. And what it is the Department of Interior and the federal government giving money to counties that have federal land because those local government entities can't tax federal lands the way they can private land. And so those annual PILT payments help to offset some of the costs with that they would normally pay with taxes. You know, so we're talking roads, mm-hmm. we're talking public safety. All 44 counties in Idaho have at least some federal land, and that can range from about 20,000 acres, I think, in Canyon County to millions of acres in central Idaho counties. But those payments per acre aren't the same per county. I got numbers from the Department of Interior on how much acreage each of those counties, how much federal acreage each of those counties have, and how much they have received in payments every year for the last 10 years. And I did some math and found that because of the way that those payments are calculated, it's a combination of how many federal acres the counties have combined with the population, that there are some counties that are getting 10 times the amount of money per acre for their federal lands as other acres. So Custer County is a perfect example. This is Challis mm-hmm. in central Idaho, the Mackey and Salmon area, very, very rural, very low population. They have 2.9 million acres of federal land. They got 29 cents per acre this past fiscal year. Ada County, for example, Ada County, on the other hand, has about 1/10 of the federal lands that Custer mm-hmm. County does, but they got 10 times as much. So in other words, Challis got 29 cents per federal acre for their PILT payment. Ada County, with a much, much higher population and far fewer federal acres, got $2.93 for those federal land wow. payments. Lots of frustration. Okay. This isn't a new story for rural county commissioners. Lots of frustration in those areas of the state. There have been ongoing talks, not just in Idaho, but with other Western states. I talked to Seth Grigg, who is the executive director of the Idaho Association of Counties. Momentum to change this in Congress isn't very high, you know, because there's not a lot of interest on a congressional level yeah. in helping out these rural communities. Because most of that representation is urban. And so there's really a lot of understanding about how this affects places like Challis or Orofino or, you know, Kellogg.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. So appreciate your time. We've been talking with Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Christina Lords and Audrey Dutton, both with the Idaho Capital Sun. And our thanks to Joe Parrish, reporter with KTVB, who joined us earlier in the show. Our senior producer is Samantha Wright. Our assistant producer is Hannah Gardosky. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday. I hope you have a good holiday weekend. And as I mentioned, we will be back here live on Tuesday.